Amory and WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward.
Always streaming on the Civic Media
News,
app.
I'm Andy Field. Moments after a lawyer for 29-year-old Kevin Salazar entered a not guilty plea by reason of insanity to murdering Los Angeles County Sheriff's Deputy Ryan Klinkenboomer, the deputy's fiance spoke out.
Ryan was the best guy I've ever met. He was so thoughtful, caring, and everyone who met him or knew him loved him.
Brittany Lindsay cried through her message of thanks to law enforcement and prosecutors. Customs and Border Protection temporarily closing the bridge at Eagle Pass, Texas due to a surge in migrants. On Capitol Hill, Attorney General Merrick Garland defending his work in the Justice Department. Accused by Republicans, including Congressman Jim Jordan, of slow-walking the Hunter Biden investigation.
The fix is in. Even with the face-saving indictment last week of Hunter Biden, everyone knows the fix is in.
Garland says he had no involvement in the special counsel investigating Hunter Biden. This is ABC News. The Biden administration launching a new workforce training initiative.
President Biden today is launching the American Climate Corps, a workforce training and service initiative for more than 20,000 Americans. The White House says this will ensure more young people have access to the skills-based training necessary for good-paying careers in the clean energy and climate resilience economy. The president had endorsed the idea of a civilian climate corps as a candidate for the White House, but it wasn't included in the Inflation Reduction Act. Dozens of Democratic lawmakers, including Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, as well as climate activists, have pushed the president to set up this initiative through executive action, as he is now doing. Karen Travers, ABC News.
With COVID cases rising across the country, the federal government once again relaunching its free COVID tests through the mail this winter. Most of Spain's World Cup winning players have ended their boycott of the women's national team after the government intervened. Andy Field, ABC News.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. The Chippewa County Sheriff's job may be in jeopardy following a four-hour closed session this week. The meeting reportedly involved concerns raised by a county employee regarding Sheriff Travis Hakes and the workplace. The precise conduct that triggered these concerns to be raised by that county employee is not yet known. A motion filed by the county board notes an October 10th meeting could involve authorizing charges and the statutory removal of the sheriff. A press release from the Chippewa County Board cited Chapter 7, Section 69 of the Chippewa County Human Resources Manual, which covers the county's workplace violence policy. Sheriff Hakes released a statement accusing the board of disregarding due process. In the statement, Sheriff Hakes stated, quote, "I realize that in many parts of this country it has become politically fashionable to disparage and bash law enforcement officers for doing their jobs. It is sad to see that these people have climbed on that bandwagon." Hakes vows to fight to keep his job against what he called unconstitutional and overreaching acts by other elected officials and their minions. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
Cranberry juice, cranberry wine, cranberry brats, cranberry cream puffs. And excuse me, but my cranberry bread is ready. It's cranberry season in Wisconsin, and we're the cranberry capital of not just the U.S., but our farmers also produce more than half of the world's cranberry supply. So can you guess which state Wisconsin beat out to earn the number one spot? New Jersey? Washington State? Massachusetts? The answer coming up. Fall is harvest time, and you can see the machines rolling through the marshlands, which are flooded to help the cranberries float to the top. But it hasn't always been this easy. Back in the mid-1800s, the berries had to be picked by hand. It took another 100 years for the right equipment to be built to help with this harvest. Okay, so Wisconsin owns the cranberry capital title, but which state lost it to us? Massachusetts, which has been number two ever since. By the way, the cranberry is the official state fruit, making it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network. Red Delicious, Honeycrisp, Granny Smith. If you have a favorite apple, now is the time to pick it straight from the source. Did you know Wisconsin has more than 300 apple orchards? Travel Wisconsin recently naming its favorites, including the Oneida National Apple Orchard outside Green Bay, Ferguson's Orchards in Eau Claire, and Apple Holler south of Racine. Many provide tons of family fun in the fall, too. Tire swings, lawn bowling, hay rides, and more. Apple experts suggest if you want to pick yours fresh, do it before the end of October. For Civic Media, I'm Terry.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
My immediate thought when I read about this and then watched it today was, please don't die, Senator McConnell. I couldn't disagree more strongly with Senator McConnell's policy positions, but he has been one of the only elected officials that's in a leadership position for the Republican Party that hasn't completely supplicated himself to Donald Trump.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Weeknights at 6 p.m.
on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Brock.
I didn't realize that Tucker Carlson's like hemorrhaging viewers. And I heard yesterday someone was like, oh yeah, like no one's actually watching it anymore. I was like, oh, yeah, that doesn't really surprise me. It's kind of like Threads.
it was a thing for about 5 minutes.
A week, everyone was excited, and then they moved on.
Wow, it's like Scott Walker's presidential campaign. It's a big deal for about a week.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ed Council and Pivotal Ventures.
Do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Interesting day of reading all of the stories about those greedy workers. Can you believe how greedy they are? Can you believe? Do you know how greedy they are? Do you know they want a 40% raise? Did you hear they want a 40% raise? How dare they? Just another day in corporate-controlled media telling us how greedy these working people are. And it's, again, not surprising. It's what we see time and time again. But I do find it quite interesting. And do you get the sense that I do? That there are some that really don't want working people to have any sense of power, any sense of the ability to change things, to make things better. Do you ever get that sense that there's something out there kind of just, well, holding you down, pushing you back, sliding everything to one end of the table? Yeah, I look at the Chicago Tribune. You know, I was looking at the editorial page. You know, the bold headline. And it's one of these things where you just go, who's over there? Now, understand, the Chicago Tribune is one of the, you know, country's, you know, most well-respected newspapers. Headline, Sean Fain is a belligerent UAW boss. There could be big trouble ahead for U.S. automakers. Now, never mind the fact that, you know, over the last decade, the big three have pocketed a quarter of $1 trillion. Never mind that. Don't let the fact get in the way. Never mind the fact that over that period of time, they have bought $66 billion in stock buybacks. I saw that number and you know, I know they're doing $5 billion now, but over the 10-year span, $66 billion in stock buybacks, which again, when a company says we're gonna buy our stocks back, there's really one reason for that. And that's to pump up the share price so that the executives make a little bit more money. You dole more of it out to the investor class, they do better. But what it's really saying is that they have no productive use for that profit other than to dole it out to the wealth class, other than to dole it out to the shareholders and to the executives. Now, in years past, in decades, let's go decades past, when unions were strong across the country, when we had 35% union density in this country, and that's in the private sector, if you were to do that, working people would have taken to the streets. And surprise, surprise, what are we doing now? You're seeing people taking to the streets. I think people have had enough of it. And for me, I keep looking in this moment and going, I'm optimistic. I'm seeing people who have had enough. I'm seeing people who are saying the struggle is too much. We're gonna do something about it. But I also see the Republican Party, the party who I say quite frequently hates working people, because they do, evidently. Look at their policies. And I used to always say, look at what they do. Look at the policies that they moved. Look at the things that they do. But now, more importantly now, listen to what they say. And yesterday we talked about Nikki Haley and her giving Joe Biden credit for the strike. And I'm sure he will take credit for that, because he is the most pro-union president of my lifetime. Because if you promote unions, those people are going to want better wages, hours, conditions. Yeah, Nikki, that's the point. And then today you've got Tim Scott. And I don't know what it is about South Carolina. Yeah, a crazy former governor who, you know, says she wears pointy-toed shoes so she can kick union people. You've got Tim Scott, the senator from South Carolina, who at a campaign event, because I don't know if you know it or not, he's running for president. His polling numbers aren't great, but he's running. Give him credit. He's giving it a go. But he had this to say. And this is, again, one of those things where you just go, listen to the words that come out of his mouth. Here's Senator Tim Scott.
I think Ronald Reagan gave us a great example when federal employees decided they were going to strike. He said, you strike, you're fired. Simple concept to me, to the extent that we could use that once again, absolutely. The second thing I would do, though, is very important. This is probably not a well-known fact. The first thing, part of the challenge that we have today with President Biden is, and I don't mean this to be disingenuous, I mean this to be sincere. I'm not sure if the words are bought and paid for, but it certainly, he has been leased by the unions. And I say that because the first bill he passed, y'all remember the $1.9 trillion COVID relief package?
Yeah.
That only had 1% for COVID vaccines? Mm-hmm. It had $86 billion, I believe, for union pensions. Oh. Because they keep making these deals. And as a result of the deal, they promise too much, deliver too little, and the taxpayers pick up the tab.
Now, again, you've got the good senator there going on about, you know, well, we should fire those workers, you know, like Ronald Reagan did, hearkening back to the good old days when you fired those Patco workers and the shot heard across the boardroom that was open season on working people, you know, like it is in South Carolina. And then he goes on into the next thing saying, look, you know, well, you know, he's bought and paid for by those unions because they shored up the multi-employer pension funds in this country. Now, it's interesting. These are a lot of loans. This will get paid back, but he never bothers with that. And he also doesn't bother talking about the fact that we have bailed out banks and bankers and the wealth class for generations. It's socialism for the wealthy. It's hardcore, you know, do or die capitalism for working people. And I reach out to my union friends, because I give Joe Biden credit for getting the Butch Lewis Act money pushed through and saving retirement for a generation, probably two. This is what angers Republicans. And the fact that that's on his mind tells you that he truly hates working people. These are the folks who want to go after Social Security. These are the people who want to gut Medicare. These are the people who are against it from the beginning. and the pension system. And the fact that he would say, you know what, we should just fire all those. Now, again, our law is workers have the right to strike. But that doesn't matter to them. They want pain and suffering for working people. And they're not shy in this moment about saying it. That's the part that's interesting to me. That they're willing to come forth and to our faces say, screw those working people. They should get what they, as my wife always told the kids, you get what you get and don't throw a fit. If you don't like it, you can go somewhere else. You can go across the street where that guy's paying even worse. It's a very different mindset from what I believe and what I think Democrats believe. We have the ability, because this is, after all, a representative democracy. We have the ability to make change and to make better lives. And a lot of us think back to, you know, when things were good for working people. Where when you, if you worked hard and played by the rules, you would actually get ahead. That there was something called an American dream instead of what has turned into a nightmare. And you know, I give these people who are walking these picket lines, I give them the ultimate credit. Like, I've done it in the past. It is difficult. It's difficult to walk across that threshold onto that picket line and know that you may not come back to work and that you're going to lose paychecks and that you're going to lose economic power in those moments. And potentially, who knows? But you're fighting for something better. You're fighting to not just make yourself in this moment better, but the future better. You know, I back in 1994, we went on strike in the freight industry. And, you know, I tell guys now, back then, the industry wanted all part-time dock workers. All of the people who have the jobs loading trucks and unloading trucks and doing that stuff now in the unionized less than truckload freight industry. They are full-time jobs today. But in 94, they wanted to make them all part-time. They wanted to red circle the number of full-time people who were working in that moment. And then as they retired, they would just phase them out and they would all be part-time and no benefits. And in 94, we said, no, we care about the unborn. We care about the future worker who's going to take this job and want to support a family with it. And thank goodness we did, because those people who are working those jobs now are grateful for the full-time wages, the full-time benefits, the pension that comes with it. And that is what I want for everyone. So good on these workers. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, John Fetterman. Big fan of John Fetterman. John, I've known him for years. When he was mayor of Braddock, we used to have him on the program all the time. He issued a statement today, said, if those jagoffs in the House stop trying to shut down our government and fully support Ukraine, then I will save democracy by wearing a suit on the Senate floor next week. Because that was the big issue yesterday, wasn't it? The big issue was, well, he's going to wear shorts and a hoodie. He's going to destroy the nation. While they're literally attempting to destroy the nation. Let's go to the phones. We got Steve in Chicago on line one. Steve, how are you?
Fine. fine, thank you. And I think you're dead on with regard to where conservatives are in terms of workers making any sort of meaningful progress. You know, that this is wash, rinse, and repeat. Yeah, I watched during COVID because my niece and nephew came to stay with me. Their parents tested positive, so they stayed with me for about a week. And they started watching some of the old Turner Classic movies that I like. And you know, one of the movies we watched was The Grapes of Wrath. And, you know, I'm sort of explaining them because they weren't terribly familiar with what happened during the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl and so forth, which the film centers on. And my nephew asked me, what are they talking about when they say Reds? I'm like, well, that was a way in which the powers that be would sort of slander the people who were standing up for workers' rights, for rights of the people to not starve in the streets. And they would slander them by calling them Reds, i.e., you know, that they're communists, something akin to what was going on in the Soviet Union. And you see this over and over again. You know, when we were trying to pass the Affordable Care Act, you know, you remember the death panels and all of this? Well, I mean, I was convinced at the time, and I wrote about it, and fast forward, it turns out that it was true, that the Republicans were as much afraid of the precedent that that would set as anything else. You know, it was a boondoggle for the insurance companies, but the idea that government can be responsible for more than simply just getting getting you out the police when you need them, or fire, or any of the other basic things that we think of when we think of government, or providing national defense. No, the government can actually help provide for education and health care and retirement and all sorts of other things like they do in the rest of the developed world. So the fear was, if we actually passed it, people might start to getting used to this sort of thing. Who knows what else they might start to pass? Decent wages, decent retirement, pensions, and quality of life, and all of these things. And if that happens, then, you know, the super rich don't get to be super rich any longer. And we might have to actually share some of what we have. And that, again, that I think was the fear, that it's the precedent that it sets. And now, of course, you're seeing this revitalization of the union movement in this country that we haven't seen in decades. And you're seeing all sorts of progress on any number of fronts, and it scares the hell out of people. And of course, you know, the only thing that you get from them, oh, well, you know, these people want to turn America into North Korea or China. You know, it's the Chinese Communist Party that's really pushing all of this stuff because they own Joe Biden. I mean, that's not a coincidence. You could try and tie Joe Biden to a lot of different elements, you know, around the world. But hey, the Chinese Communist Party, that's the one that might resonate, especially with older voters.
Yeah, because you can't use Russia anymore.
You can't use Russia anymore. Apparently, an authoritarian regime, when it was the Soviet Union, was the evil empire and had to be fought at all costs. But as long as they are no longer officially a communist country, then they can get away with anything, and we're willing to look the other way. As a matter of fact, we're willing to even support them in some ways. So, I mean, that's always interesting, you know. I mean, the Republican Party that was determined to fight communism, i.e. the Soviet Union, for decades, now you have a man in charge there in the Soviet, there in Russia, what used to be the Soviet Union, that was literally part of the KGB, and they don't care, you know. As long as they're not the communists that they used to be, we don't care. You know, we'll move on. It's China that's the threat now.
Yeah, as you were talking about the Affordable Care Act, I was remembering Michelle Bachmann. Do you remember Crazy Michelle? She laid out exactly what you said. She said that, you know, she's afraid that once people get, you know, much like Medicare, once people get it, they're going to want to hold on to it, and they're going to want to make it better. And that was my hope as well. It was my hope for the ACA, was that we would make it better, because there are some problems with it, that we would get a hold of it, that people would, you know, say this is a good thing for us. And the Republicans have done a masterful job of gridlocking, of delaying, of repeal and replace with who knows what, 100 times plus, and we haven't made it better substantially, and we still need to.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people, I've discussed and debated with people on this issue, and I don't know whether some of them are just ignorant of the history of this society, or are just, you know, out there to promote their vision of whatever propaganda is being fed to them. Yeah, I've had discussions where people will talk about, well, you know what, my grandparents or great-grandparents didn't have any of this stuff. Okay, so let's examine what period you're talking about. And we'll talk about Chicago in the early 20th century, late 19th century, you know, how horrible it was here. You know, this was the center of the meat packing industry. How horrible it was to work in those conditions. You know, the jungle, one of the greatest books of this, of its time, you know, about how terrible it was. You went to work when you were, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old. You died 40, 50 years later working. You lived in a shack. You had no indoor plumbing. You had no health care. You worked 6, maybe 7 days a week, 10, 12, 14 hours a day. And so the idea of how many people's lives were just wasted, consumed by this system. You didn't have any vacations to think about or time off or the weekends or anything else. You went to work, you ate of what you made, and then you hope that your kids had the same opportunity that you have, and that was it. We used up so many generations of people's lives in this country to build that great American dream that the people love to talk about. Like, well, this is what my grandparents did. Like, you want to say, did you ever actually talk to your grandparents or great-grandparents? I mean, because trust me, they would not have that experience unless they were, you know, a part of the professional class or wealthy. Because I guarantee you, Chicago's a city of immigrants here, and that is not the experience that immigrants had their first and second generation being here.
No, my grandfather, he told me back in the late 20s, they were shoveling coal off the back of a coal truck for 17 cents an hour, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you hurt yourself, if something happened, all right, well, move off of the line, go home, pick up what you earned so far, somebody else comes in.
Yep.
Hey, you got whatever, you know, you broke something, you got frostbite, it's 5 below out here, your problem, not ours. I mean, is that the America that we want to live in? No, the idea here is that we're supposed to be making progress towards something better.
No, Steve, that's not the American we want to live in, but that is the America that our Republican friends want to move us back to. They want to take us back to the Lochner era. They want to take us back to an era where if you were hungry enough and desperate enough to work in deplorable conditions for poverty wages, that was your freedom. It was your liberty. Liberty of contract was a thing for a long time where, hey, if you want to work 100 hours, you know, for no wages, that's your freedom. Even though you didn't have a choice, you had to feed your family.
Yeah, that's the libertarian mantra. So for people who don't know it, so in other words, it's perfectly fine for a few people at the top to conspire to fix wages and to deny unions and all of this sort of thing. But if workers do it, that somehow infringes upon the free market. So if I gather together with all of my buddies who are working in a factory, we say, you know, we're going to unionize, we're going to hold out for more. That interferes with the free market. But it's perfectly fine to create all sorts of systems that prevent average people from elevating themselves out of poverty. No, that's fine. You can do that. It doesn't infringe upon the free market at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's scary times. And I'm sure you saw the New York Times piece today on the child labor violations that are going on in Virginia. A 14-year-old kid had his arm shredded at a Purdue slaughterhouse. In Virginia last year, and everybody covered it up. The police, the community, because the slaughterhouses would not operate without child labor, according to the report.
Absolutely. And what happened was, especially during COVID, I mean, let's face it, we were all sitting at home, and we wanted to keep ordering from the restaurants, or we wanted to get our food, including our meat, delivered, and we didn't really care about where it was coming from. You know where it was coming from? It was coming from a lot of people that we want to vilify as being here illegally, undocumented, and so forth. They were the ones still working. They, you can't do that job remotely.
Yeah.
Some people still had to go to work, and those people did. And during that time frame, you know, we just let corporations get away with anything. So, okay, we need somebody. Okay, 14-year-old, put a 14-year-old on that line. We would never tolerate some suburban kid, you know, here in Chicago, who should be in high school working on that kind of line. But we tolerate it if it's the other, if it's some strange immigrant that, well, shouldn't be here anyway. So they should consider themselves fortunate to have any kind of a job.
Yeah, I'm with you, Steve. I appreciate the thoughts. Good stuff. No, but this is one of these things that there are people who want to take us back to the good old days. And those good old days weren't that great for working people. You know, the slaughterhouses that worked during the pandemic, and as Steve was laying out his thoughts, I was remembering that, you know, you had management who were taking those others and betting on how many of them they could get COVID and how many of them would die and how many, this happened. So for me, this is very cut and dry. I look at the people who are telling us, the Nikki Haley's, the Tim Scott's, that we'd fire those workers and that they're greedy and it's all Joe Biden's fault. And, you know, trying to whip up that hysteria. Which side of this are you on? As I say all the time, I'm on the side of the working people. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2012. That was the day the Chicago Teachers Union walked off the job for the first time in 25 years. The historic week-long strike resonated nationwide among trade unionists and served to reinvigorate the labor movement. Certainly, higher wages and better benefits were among the teachers' demands. The city's mayor, Rahm Emanuel, had canceled the union's wage increase, laid off close to 1,000 teachers, and went on the attack against seniority rights and working conditions. The strike enjoyed wide public support among parents and the public. Teachers emphasized broader educational problems they faced, namely the attacks fueled by corporate privatization. They wanted a return to more traditional forms of education rather than simply preparing students for endless rounds of testing. They wanted more art, music, and gym classes. And they demanded stable funding for social support services for the most vulnerable at-risk students. Union teachers understood that the Board of Education was using standardized testing to get rid of teachers and schools in order to privatize education, all in the name of turning around failing schools and helping the kids. Though the contract was less than perfect, it showed the power working people have to hold the line against continued assaults on their standards of living, especially in the public sector. The CTU was able to beat back attempts at merit pay and increased use of student test scores in teacher evaluations. They won first-time recall rights, supply reimbursements, and liberal arts classes. There were concessions, however, made on seniority rights, pay for laid-off teachers, and longer workdays. But the CTU demonstrated that strikes can win in a period of extended anti-union onslaughts. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Corporate and governmental hucksters intentionally cloak their schemes in convoluted obfuscations, so we commoners can't really know what they're saying or doing to us. That's why our Hightower Lowdown team takes pride in regularly trying to deconstruct their arcane jargon, translating it into plain language. Recently, for example, I pointed out the slick deceit in Big Pharma's assertion that its outrageously high drug prices are just a factor of, quote, core cost recovery. Huh? That's supposed to mean that it costs a lot to do basic research for discovering new medicines, so they must recover those costs. But wait, I hollered, basic drug research is not paid for by brand-name corporate monopolists. Rather, this essential humane work is done by such public entities as the National Institutes of Health, paid for by us taxpayers. And it's a huge tax-paid subsidy. In 2020, a study by the Institute of New Economic Thinking laid out the scam in stark terms, quote, taxpayers have been footing the bill for every new drug approved between 2010 and 2019. Hello, every new drug. The Institute's study traced the funding of 356 new drugs approved in that period, finding that a whopping $230 billion in public finance research paid for the basic science that created the medicines. In what the researchers called a robust pipeline to industry, monopolistic patents were then obtained on those ingredients by Big Pharma to market drugs made possible by the scientific capital we taxpayers invested. This is Jim Hightower saying, for drug profiteers, this is manna from heaven. The system hands new drug products to them, letting them arbitrarily fix prices that enrich their investors with nearly double the profit levels of other corporate powers. If you suspect the system is rigged to gouge you, there it is.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I've been saying for years, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. And now, look at what they're saying. You know, as I've been saying for the past couple of days, you got Nikki Haley going, you know, it's all Joe Biden's fault. When you tell people they can unionize, they do. And they fight for wages, hours, and conditions. And they want better. See, we need to kick them with those pointy-toed shoes that she so told those Walmart shareholders she wore to kick unions when she was governor of South Carolina. And now you got Tim Scott saying, fire them all. Yeah. So when do we throw these bums out? Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the latest revelations. I've asked Noah Leonard to come talk with us. Noah's a reporter over at Mother Jones Magazine. He's got a piece out. Nikki Haley and Tim Scott are here to remind you, Republicans hate unions. Noah, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me on. Yeah, this is one of those ones where you don't the headline doesn't make it too ambiguous for you. It cuts straight to the point. But yeah, like you said, this week was I was actually surprised, not by that's maybe what they would say in private, but that's what they're saying in public as presidential candidates in 2023. I mean, you had Tim Scott saying basically fire them all if that's legal. Obviously, he was unaware that it is not legal and you cannot fire private sector workers en masse, willy-nilly. And then, yes, you have Nikki Haley, I mean, just saying, I was a union buster as governor. That's her quote. So yeah, not making it subtle at all. And it's also happening at the same time that you have Donald Trump kind of making a very hollow and phony play for union voters by going to Detroit next week. So there's at least a contrast in message, if not in substance, this time around on the Republican side.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting when the debate is going on, because Trump has said he's going to go to one of the picket lines, I guess the picket line in Michigan, on the date of the debate. It's going to be interesting to listen to the people who are on stage bashing workers and bashing unions, especially the UAW, and then Trump trying to walk that line. I thought his comment was quite interesting. You know, he kind of wanted to support the striking workers, but then attacked Sean Fain and the leadership because they've sold him out. They've sold them out. It seemed like, well, one of the most Trumpian things ever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. Absolutely. You know, he's playing both sides. I mean, he's definitely, you know, for all the other things you can say about him, he's a savvy operator in certain respects. And this is, you know, yeah, it's a smart move. He's going to be in Detroit speaking to current and former union members, not just auto workers, but a variety. I'm not sure he could get 500 auto workers, you know, there, which is what they say they want, but we'll see. But yes, I mean, I also mentioned this in the article. I mean, the debate's happening at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library. So, I mean, it really is like you could not ask for a better contrast and scenery of where these two things are happening. So you're going to have people in California at the Reagan Library talking about, you know, potentially talking about the firing of air traffic controllers in the PATCO strike, and Trump doing whatever he's going to do, which is not going to be to support the union's demands. I assume really it's going to be to do this wedge that he's driving. And one thing about that is it kind of does, even though it's a smart political play, but it reminds me a lot of what you see in union busting campaigns is, you know, drive a wedge between the members and their leadership. It happens all the time. You know, the company will say, we love unions, support unions, just not this one. Right. And that's, you know, Trump's not exactly doing that, but it's a version of it.
No, the right does that masterfully. I know some conservative think tank people who they play that. You know, we don't hate unions, just all of these. All of the ones that are out there. But we don't, you know, conceptually. But, you know, what I'm interested to see is when he goes to Michigan, will he attempt to revive the Lordstown lie? I mean, are we going back to that? Because if you remember, he told all those auto workers, you know, don't sell your house, don't take those job transfers, don't follow the work anywhere else. We're saving Lordstown for you.
Yeah.
And, well, it's the Lordstown lie.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously we know Donald Trump is not concerned at all with sticking to facts even remotely. So I would completely expect that. And even the line that he's taken on this, obviously there's a lot of legitimate and real concern about how the transition to electric vehicles is going to affect auto workers and UAW members. We all know that. But I mean, the idea of what Trump's thinking here doesn't really make much sense. He's just saying all electric cars, he said, automatically will be made in China, which is not what's happening here. I mean, Joe Biden is promoting a lot of EV manufacturing, and there's concern that those factories are going to be in right-to-work states, and many will be. But there's not this future that Donald Trump is imagining where all the electric vehicles are made in China doesn't really make much sense, and also doesn't fit with what our policy is right now.
But if we have someone in the White House, if we have a a set of politicians who open up our borders to Chinese EVs, we will, because there are like 25 million of them just sitting over in China waiting for a market to be dumped into. This is where, you know, having politicians who aren't going to sell us down the river, kind of important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there's definitely a world in which this could go really poorly for auto workers beyond the just difficulties we know about in already in terms of the potential, you know, fewer workers needed to make these vehicles because of just, you know, how the technology works. So it's very concerning for, you know, for the auto industry and auto workers, how this could shape out. I mean, I think it's been interesting to see Biden kind of and the administration kind of change tune. You know, you had these initial loans go to Ford for $9 billion with kind of no strings attached on worker protections, unionization, or anything. And of course, justifiably, you know, there was huge blowback from the UAW on that. And then you saw earlier this month that a new round of, you know, loans and grants were announced, and that they had kind of reconfigured it. They put out the announcement just in time for Labor Day, saying basically, you know, in a way it was a version of mea culpa, but like, we heard you and we're not going to keep pulling this again.
Now, I do want to go back to Nikki Haley's comments.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because she gives credit to Biden. You know, says, look, you know, he's responsible for this. He's promoted unions. He's said go, 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 and they've done this. I think this is a great campaign ad, because I don't know, being on the side of working people and promoting better economics for working people, I don't know that's a bad thing. Now, I know who Nikki Haley was talking to. I know who Tim Scott was talking to. It's not the people who were doing the jobs, you know, building cars or plowing fields. It's the CEO class. It's the folks who at the big three pocketed a 40% wage increase over the last 4 years. Those are the people they're talking to. So my thought and my hope in this is that we pay attention and actually listen to the words coming out of their mouth.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. And I was just pulling up while you're talking, you know, one of the direct quotes from this is, yeah, I mean, she said, you know, in this interview, but when you have a president that's constantly saying, go union, this is what you get. And, you know, in a world in which this works out well for the UAW, and they get a strong contract, and, they, you know, as Biden and the union have said, record profits does mean a record contract. I mean, yeah, it's a very good, definitely something for Biden to be running on. And I also think it's interesting in her remarks, too. It's like this distinction she creates between, you know, taxpayers and union members. She was saying, you know, if taxpayers were offered a 20% raise, I'm sure they'd be thrilled, basically saying these greedy, good for nothing union members won't take 20%. And of course, it's BS. And, you know, in the sense, this is 20% over 4.5 years happening after years of high inflation. No COLAs are part of that. But yeah, this idea that union members are not taxpayers. At the same time, these companies are paying basically nothing in federal taxes. So they are not really taxpayers.
And this is one of those things that I talked about the other day, because you bring up this idea of union members and taxpayers. You know, oddly enough, union members pay higher taxes because they make more money. So the more they earn, the more they pay. That's how our system works. What's happened over the years is wages have been so stagnant. And, you know, when Mitt Romney, you remember back in 2012, he got hammered for saying 47% of the people pay no federal taxes. And I said, you know what? Those 47% of people would love to pay taxes. They would jump for joy to pay taxes because it means that they'd be making more money. For me, this is one of those moments where we should be flipping the script on this and saying, look, yeah, I'd be happy to pay more taxes if it meant I had more money in my paycheck.
I think absolutely. I mean, workers would be thrilled in this case to be paying more taxes and to be able to do this. I mean, it's kind of, you know, absurd at this point. And I get into some of this in the article, but it's like, it just doesn't even make sense where this is coming from. I mean, it's a problem for Democrats, but 40% of union members are estimated to have voted for Republican Donald Trump in the last presidential election. So, you know, why you have a presidential candidate getting out there and saying this? I mean, they are like, it makes no sense politically. And, you know, it's kind of shocking just how easy it is for Donald Trump to run away with this primary, given the quality of the opposition he's up against in terms of strategy. And these also just aren't any union members. These are, you know, these are workers from the biggest industry in a key battleground state that Trump has won before and almost won a second time in 2020. It's pretty mystifying, but maybe that also explains why, you know, where Nikki Haley is in the polls.
I somewhat understood union members voting for Trump in 2016. I did. I somewhat understood it. It wasn't the racism. It wasn't the homophobia. It wasn't the misogyny. That's not what got them to vote. Now, for some, obviously it did. But I think for union members, it was especially, auto workers and industrial workers. It was the hope that Trump would do what he said and bring back manufacturing. Basically what Biden is doing right now, they hoped Trump would do. All the Lordstown lie. I go back to this. All of those people who believed that Trump alone could have saved that plant. And look, I remember driving past the Lordstown plant, when I lived in Cleveland, and you would see, 1,000 cars in the parking lot packed, morning, noon, and night. And now it's got a couple of little trying battery things or something in there, employs a couple of people. Those folks needed, wanted, and hoped those jobs would stay. And Trump told them, I alone can do it. And he lied.
Yeah. I mean, it's especially after, being ignored in so many ways over the recent decades, if someone comes around saying they're going to do something for you, you can see why it's a potent message. But I'm glad you brought that up too. And I'll write another piece for next week before Trump's speech. But it is easy just to forget how terrible his administration was for unions. Even though it was only, 2-3 years ago, it was just atrocious. What the National Labor Relations Board was doing, one of the things I think that really captures is the Chamber of Commerce going into 2016 had made a list of their top 10 priorities that they wanted to see labor get done in labor in a Republican presidency. Trump did all 10 and did them quite quickly.
Yep.
This was a shopping list for the Chamber of Commerce and business groups. And, you have Antonin Scalia's son being the labor secretary, his original pick being a fast food executive. It's a joke. I think it's easy. It gets missed a lot because I think sometimes the media can focus too much on, will this strategy work or won't it, as opposed to the substance of what did he actually do when he was president?
No, you're spot on. Our media looks at the horse race and tries to figure out, how to do the both sidesism. And, someone told me today, if Trump had murdered a puppy on stage, the headline would be, Trump murders puppy. Here's why it's bad for Joe Biden. Here's why it's Joe Biden's fault.
Yeah. And without, being a partisan about it or, saying he's perfect when he's not. It is also worth remembering the flip side is it's not just that Trump was very bad for unions, is that Joe Biden, for the most part, you could point to some exceptions, has been unusually good for a Democratic president, especially when it comes to the National Labor Relations Board.
Yep.
And union organizing.
I said, and I said this before and I'll stand by it. If he did nothing but appoint Jennifer Abruzzo as the head of the NLRB, I'm happy with his administration. Now you throw in all the accomplishments, the rescue plan, the infrastructure bill. You throw in all of the things that have come around that. That just makes it so much better. But the people that he's put into positions of power to help undo some of the damage of the past, to help us get an opportunity to fight for better wages, hours, and conditions, I'm thrilled with it.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot to be happy with, and there's more. We're still not through this administration, so I think that. And sometimes he's like, there's a lot of discussion now, and I think it can be important and not to dismiss it, but will he go to the picket line or will he not, Joe Biden? And it's easy. There's a lot of what's more substantive than that is what his Department of Labor, what the Labor Relations Board is doing, and I think that often doesn't get a lot of coverage. It's not the thing that is often focused.
I said from the beginning, I think he borrows Obama's comfortable shoes because Obama promised us that he was going to walk a picket line. He had comfortable shoes. He was going to do it. Never broke those out. Maybe Biden can borrow him and walk the line, or at least maybe send Obama to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And one thing on this, I'm saying, kind of my views here and, but I would also add, if there are any auto workers, particularly on strike, but any UAW members of the Big Three listening to this, I'm eager to talk to as many of you as possible. So, I'm easy to find on motherjones.com or on Twitter. Eager to get your perspective, confidentially or on the record as well.
Now we're going to be heading, we at the program, we're going to be heading there this weekend out to Toledo on Saturday and up to Wayne on Sunday. Depending on what happens. If they shuffle things around, we'll move where we need to go. But we want to go out and do as many, have as many opportunities to talk to people, because ultimately we're in a which side are you on moment in this country. At least I think so.
Yeah, I mean, I also think like it's just been amazing to watch, you know, Sean Fain. And I guess I should say full disclosure, I'm a UAW member as well through our union. But like to see Sean Fain and the way he's framing this, it's so refreshing. It's not the kind of rhetoric you hear from just very much anymore. You know, talking about like, yes, we don't like this economy and we're going to wreck it. And there's just kind of no ifs, ands, or buts about it. But he's also, you know, yeah, and turning to scripture to make his case. I mean, it's been very pretty amazing to watch him go about leading this strike as well.
No, what I like that he's done is, you know, one of the frames that we use here on the program all the time is, you know, it's not red hat, blue hat, it's up down. It's not right, left, it's up down. It's always been up down. Yeah. They force us into red hat, blue hat, left, right. They force us in that, so we eat each other. He's saying, look, you know, when it was said that Trump was going to show up, he goes, you know, he's the kind of person that we're going after. We're going after billionaires, the kind of person that he is. And I thought that was the right frame.
Yeah, no, I was interested when Trump was initially saying something. I was, you know, I wondered what they would say. Would they say, you know, we welcome any support. We're not taking sides, you know, because obviously, you know, members have a wide range of political views and a wide range of attitudes towards Trump. But it was fun to see them come out immediately and just say, basically, screw this guy. He's a billionaire. And that's exactly what we're against.
Yeah, a good piece, though. I hope folks will take a look at it. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at it. I think you guys are doing great work over there at Mother Jones. But the piece, Nikki Haley and Tim Scott are here to remind you Republicans hate unions. And the Rick Smith Show will tell you Republicans hate working people. Just look at what they do. MotherJones.com, the website. Noah, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Good stuff, man.
Of course. Thank you.
Noah Leonard, again, make sure you check out the work that he does over there at Mother Jones. Going to take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1830. That was the day that the Reverend Richard Allen brought black leaders together at his Mother Bethel AME Church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They met to discuss the rising white violence and discrimination toward black free residents in northern cities. 40 people answered Allen's call, representing 7 states. The delegates included many of the leading black ministers and abolitionists of the day. Those who attended risked personal harm as white mobs threatened the delegates. Due to the danger, the group met in secret starting on September 15th. Then, on this day, they began open sessions. For 5 days, the delegates considered multiple responses to the conditions black Northerners faced. They founded the American Society for Free Persons of Color for improving their conditions in the United States, for purchasing lands, and for establishment of a settlement in the province of Canada. The organization emphasized pushing for legal protections for black residents in the United States. They focused on education as a means of uplifting and improving the lives of black citizens. But delegates also supported the idea of an outlet to Canada for those black families who wanted to leave for their safety. The National Convention reconvened several times over the next 3 decades. Multiple meetings were held at the state and local levels. These meetings gave black leaders a chance to devise coordinated strategies to stand up against the increasing violence and restrictive laws of the North and to call for an end of slavery in the South. One outcome of these meetings was the founding of labor schools to train black students in the skilled trades as a means to gain economic independence. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So, I'm going to use a boo-boo word here. So if you're easily triggered, stick your fingers in your ears for about the next 15 seconds, because this is bad. It's bad. Evidently, there's a new book out on Rupert Murdoch, Michael Wolff's new book. According to the Daily Beast, Rupert Murdoch described Sean Hannity Fox's host as, well, he said he's retarded, like most Americans. And it's interesting that that's the word that they used for Sean Hannity and for most Americans. You know, the people who watch the F channel? That's what Rupert thinks of the people who watch his garbage. You surprised? Not even a little bit. Some really great news coming out of my state of Pennsylvania. I got to tell you, really like Josh Shapiro as governor. Going to be a great president one day. But Pennsylvania announced yesterday that we will become the 24th state to implement automatic voter registration. You will automatically be registered to vote when you renew your, when you get a new license or you renew your license, automatic. You have to opt out. If you don't want to vote, you got to go, hey, no, not me. I'm not voting. And there are some people who still think that that's how they choose people for jury duty. And they'll be dumb enough to go, no, I don't want to. But this is a big deal. This is a, you know, kind of a, you know, a jab at the Mastrianos of the world. Let's go to the phones. Got Alice on line one. Alice, how are you?
Totally insane. So what I wanted to say was, you know, these, the right wing is just losing their mind over this UAW strike. And in the Washington Post, yesterday there was a couple of op-eds, and then today that George F. Will, and he's like a nut job, wrote one, and the UAW can strike, but it's running out of gas. You know, and then they're going on and on, you know, how basically the union's bad and they're greedy. And I'm thinking to myself, people actually believe this that are on the right wing. I don't know what, you know, where their brains are, because they're believing this stuff. And yet some of them are working in the same fields where there are unions. And because I know a couple, and they're like, well, yeah, and this always cracks me up. Well, I'm not worried about that because we have a union, and even though I don't belong to it. And I'm like, just looking at them going, really? So in one breath you're saying the union's bad, and in the next breath you're going, but don't fight for me.
Yeah, because they don't have, because they have to.
It's just insane. But you have a good evening, Rick.
Thanks, Alice. Appreciate it. No, the reality is, and this is where, you know, I'm hoping in this moment, you know, we're able to have a national conversation around, you know, what Republicans are really out loud saying. They're saying that they want workers to work for poverty wages. They are saying out loud to our faces that you're not worth a decent wage. It's what they're saying. Nikki Haley, the union buster governor, was quite happy to say out loud in front of people that she didn't want unions to come in and change the environment, which means the workers of South Carolina are quite, you know, they're quite happy working for virtually nothing. They're happy working for poverty wages. They're happy making shareholders billions of dollars and with no protection whatsoever. They're saying this stuff out loud. And look, you know, the scary part of this is a lot of the new manufacturing is ending up in states that are run by people like Nikki Haley, are going to red states. Because wouldn't you, if you think about this, if you had the chance to avoid unions and workers saying, hey, I want a fair share of what my wealth, what my work creates, you can go to a place where you have absolute dictatorial control. You can hire and fire at will with no one to hold you accountable in any way, shape, or form. You are the king of the castle. Wouldn't you do it? This is what corporate America has been getting away with. And the reason, again, how horribly broken our labor laws are. Workers in the South want to organize. Don't be fooled by the rhetoric. They want to unionize. They want to have a better life. It's just the laws are so badly stacked against them. Look at what happened in Alabama at the Bessemer Amazon plant. All of the harassment, the intimidation, the constant berating of these employees. But something good happened. The NLRB ruled in the CEMEX case that, you know what? If you violate the law, if you break the law, no more. No more, oh, posted notice. No more promise not to do it again until the next time you do it. Now they're saying, we're just going to impose union recognition. This could be a game changer, especially in the South. And again, this is why.
You're listening to WLAK 1260 AM Emory and WBZH 910 AM W245 CT Hayward.
Always streaming on the Civic ABC Media app.